group in charge of improving downtown Hemming Park is at a crossroads. Good Tuesday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. The show's always live at 9. Make sure to subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and watch the show video on demand with our partners TVJax.com, MetroJacksonville.com. Just ahead, we'll take your calls on the fate of Friends of Hemming Park. Get on the line now, 549-2937. Then later, how to transform your workplace. We'll tell you about this week's workshop on radical collaboration. Plus, a live in-studio performance as we look ahead to this weekend's Florida Folk Festival. All of that and more ahead. But first this hour, could it be do or die for Friends of Hemming Park? The organization needs money and needs it right now. $250,000 from the city this week, or it could be forced to shut down. This puts the group's long-term vision for beautifying and programming the downtown space in limbo. Right now, we're going to take a close look at what's at stake and what we could see happening in the city hall chambers this week as we welcome Executive Director of Friends of Hemming Park, Vince Cavett, to the studio. Vince, good to see you.
Thank you, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
And here's our question to callers. What are your thoughts about the funding challenge for Friends of Hemming Park? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email, tweet the show, weigh in on Facebook. So tonight at City Council, you will make a request to the council chambers and the representatives there, $250,000 to keep operating. Can you explain why Friends of Hemming Park needs those funds?
Friends of Hemming Park needs those funds because we allocated $250,000 in our budget from last year. We saw that there was a gap between the 18 months of funding and to close out the remainder of the fiscal year, carrying us to September 2016. So we made that request to the mayor after he was elected. Mayor Curry said, I can get that 250 into the budget, and that's what happened. So City Council passed that last year, that the 250 was part of that inclusion. And we need that right now to continue our operations. Brought into the conversation was the community first stage, which we started working on back in August of last year. Coincidentally, that's also an amount of $250,000 to build out a stage. And when we made the request for the mayor's allocation back in February, one of the council members said, why don't we take that $250,000 that community first is giving you for the stage and swap it with this operations and management money from the city, and therefore the city can lead with the stage as a capital improvement, and that can probably be an easier sell, and we can get this through council within a few weeks. Well, it's just ended up being a lot more complex to work out the details, and so here we are 15 weeks later in need of the 250 still, and so we're requesting that today.
The mayor's office, his administration, has been very supportive of Friends of Hemming Park and your efforts to provide daily programming in the downtown park, beautify it, bring food to the space, and as you said, a stage, all ways to attract more people to the urban core. However, some city council members, particularly those on the finance committee, have publicly expressed concern about providing taxpayer dollars to the organization. What's your response to those criticisms?
So the key thing to remember is that this is a city project. It is a city park, and that there is an amount of money that needs to go into maintain it regularly. But now you have an operation that is trying to program and beautify it on an ongoing basis. So our position is that if you take a look at other parks, similar parks, some smaller parks, they receive substantial city dollars to keep it going, to make it an active place to be. And our position is that we're not just a park. We're part of the driver for downtown revitalization. What we're doing is one of the first items on the Downtown Investment Authority's agenda to revitalize downtown. So we were activated, but we need city support to keep on going.
We'll go to your calls for Friends of Hemming Park's Vince Cavan in a moment. What are your thoughts about this issue involving the group trying to enhance the downtown park? 549-2937. The other day, TU columnist Ron Littlepage wrote about this issue, and he said that for every spurt of momentum that gets going for revitalizing downtown Jacksonville, there's a momentum killer. He said, Jacksonville is a lot like crabs in a pot. If one is reaching for freedom and about to move on to something good, another crab pulls it back down. Do you agree with that?
Not always. I mean, there's many stakeholders who are supportive of us. You know, we do see the iterative steps to improve, but I think we need to be bold and courageous and make some huge investments in downtown to create that heart of the city that everybody, I think, envisions will transform our city entirely. I mean, Heming Park, you know, is one part of downtown revitalization, and these efforts are the kind of efforts that put us on best of lists. You know, they're kind of the kind of efforts that create first-tier cities. So we hope that momentum continues, and I hope we don't get dragged down too far.
Why do you think, though, not everyone's on board with that vision? You're trying to make the case that investing in this effort will pay off for the city as a whole.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that it's a case of just more nuanced education, probably one-on-one with those members of the Finance Committee. You know, I think that's my responsibility to go in on a continual basis, maybe more often, to educate and talk about, you know, our plan and our strategy and how we're squeezing every city dollar into great outcomes. For instance, for every city dollar spent, we've been able to capture about $1.75 in value. So $1 million has been invested from the city, but we've also raised $1.3 million in commitments from in-kind donors, as well as raising $442,000 from events and sponsorships in cash.
And we'll go to your calls in just a moment as we speak with Vince Cavan of Friends of Heming Park. What are your questions as the organization fights for funding from the city? 549-2937 is the number to join us. Let's go to a few emails, tweets, and Facebook comments. Here is an email from Rob in Murray Hill. Having witnessed the renaissance of Heming Park recently under Vince's leadership, I would urge the city to continue the support for this vital centerpiece of our city. Yoga for Change tweets the show, sending support to Heming Park while they are on the radio. And here is a comment on our Facebook page. Jenny, I don't have any questions for Vince, but just praise. Since the launch of Heming's new mission, it has quickly become the epicenter of downtown Jacksonville. They really cleaned it up and turned it into a regular hotspot, a place for everyone to enjoy. It would be a major shame to let this new Jacksonville icon slip right through their fingers. So you're getting a lot of support on social media.
Yeah.
But let me play devil's advocate and say, what about the other side? For example, council member John Cressenbeny quoted the other day saying, I just don't get the feeling they're trying to pinch pennies over there, referring to Friends of the Park.
Right. And I think that goes back to the continual education and just showing and laying out the case. Like, here's our numbers. Here's our metrics. Here's our books, completely open, totally transparent. But to get to the heart of his comment, he has mentioned that before, and he expanded on that in a previous conversation, and that's where we get to the conversation about it's $1.75 that we've leveraged out of the city's investment. And for 20 months, we think that's pretty spectacular. Mm-hmm. Most nonprofits can't do that at the startup stage, so we have been able to.
If you can get through this current situation and secure a more stable funding source, what's the long-term vision that you and others share, and the founder of this group, Wayne Wood, for this downtown space? What would you like to see happen over the long term?
We would like to see it become a sort of epicenter and focal point for a lot of outdoor events, more free programming, which we provide right now, but expand on that. And the transformation, the big picture, is more green space, more walkable, create a level park. Right now, sort of bifurcated into two spaces with the stairs separating it. Definitely a sign of its times. In the 70s, it's not even ADA compliant. So one unified park, more green space, much more open, sort of open up the canopy, create more of destination focal points, such as an antique carousel is on the table. That's what we put in a five-year plan. We think that that will transform the family experience, bring a lot more kids downtown, for example, to experience that. An amphitheater to focus attention on the stage, that's definitely part of it. And building out another kid zone. So right now we have sort of a temporary kid zone that we set up every day, but to do something more substantial that creates that draw for DCPS and other groups.
And to our callers, what would you like to see happen to downtown Heming Park? I can't believe no one's calling in on this. This is unprecedented. It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Now, the mayor's office, city council, justifiably very concerned right now with the matter of the pension liability that's dragging down Jacksonville's finances. And the mayor has said there really can't be any additional funding for any other projects until that matter gets resolved. This summer, voters will be asked to vote up or down a half-cent sales tax extension to deal with that liability. What are your thoughts about how that massive problem is affecting initiatives like yours, like Friends of Hemming Park?
Yeah, it's critical to get the pension passed. I mean, it frees up the cash flow for the city and allows for the conversation to be much greater about how we're going to invest downtown, and Hemming Park's a part of that. So, you know, we've been told there's no guarantees until after August. You know, then we'll start talking about whether or not we will fund Hemming Park in the future for the five-year, making a stake for the five-year plan.
And should the worst happen and funding not come through, what's going to happen? Let's explain the way forward for Hemming Park.
Yeah. So I think, you know, if the funding comes through today, that's wonderful. Then we can continue operations. If it does not, we will begin winding down operations in June, satisfy all our vendors, and let Jacksonville start again.
All right. Lots of calls coming in now for Vince Cavan of Friends of Hemming Park. Coral in Neptune Beach. Go ahead, Coral. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. My office overlooks Hemming Plaza, and I walk by every day. And what the organization has done has really been, they've made tremendous strides. I was very impressed. My only concern is I know that they're trying to attract more families, and there's still a large semi-homeless population that tends to frequent the park all day long, and I think that still presents a safety risk. And I was wondering if there's been any research done to determine the increased participation of families and children.
Yeah, thanks for that question, Coral. Vince?
Yep, absolutely. And there's been a lot of influx in families and children, particularly with DCPS bringing in kids directly. But we also have partnerships with Jack's Mom's Blog, where we do a Toddler Tuesday every Tuesday. It brings lots of kids into the park and specifically into our kid zone. We do know the social service need is great down there, so we're building a coalition with other groups. We have Sulzbacher as a great partner, but also Clara White and Coalition for Homelessness. So we want to bring Changing Homelessness with Don Gilman to figure out how to strategically address the homeless issue, not only in Hemming Park, but downtown as a whole. And we have a strategy we're working up that'll be part of our five-year plan.
And doesn't that piece include reopening a day drop-in center for the homeless? The funding for that has gone away as well.
Possibly, yeah. We did notice an uptick in the summer when that was closed, that there were more people there. But it's really hard to pinpoint if that's people traveling through, you know, the warmer months. I think it allows for more travel and flexibility. People just come into the park because it's there and it's around the different centers. But the centers aren't the issue. It's more just addressing the need to find out what services they need and drive them to the right organizations.
Let's go to Mike on the north side. Hi, Mike. Thanks for calling. Good morning. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm a lifetime resident of Jacksonville, born and raised here. I remember when downtown was, you know, obviously a tremendous place. That park was a great place. All I've got to say is one thing. Make the park as nice as we possibly can. That's the biggest focus we have in Jacksonville, right downtown. We need to take advantage of it. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. Marcel on the south side. Go ahead, Marcel. Thanks for your call.
Yes, hi. I'm a single father. I'm all for the revitalization of Hemming Park and making it as best as it can be and keeping up the funding. The it's hard with the obesity rate the way it is. It's hard for me as a father to try to find, you know, free activities around Jacksonville to entertain my daughter. I try to keep her as active as I can, and I try to provide her with the best opportunity for her to get as much exercise. And these parks are vital to try to keep our kids active, to try to give them a new taste of life. You know, with Hemming Park, it's a centerpiece. You know, you have the library right next door. You have beautiful activities where they can go ahead and walk around to go to places. And, you know, I think it's a shame that the city doesn't want to go ahead and see that vital need. The activities that it provides for everybody.
Okay, Marcel, thanks for that. You know, when he says the city doesn't see the vital need, let's get specific. Where are the votes on this? Do you know?
Yeah, I think we have the votes to pass what's there tonight. I think we've got our 10 that we need.
You do?
Yep, absolutely. We're meeting with a bunch of council members today to really go over what will be presented tonight. So it's a big day for us.
Laura is in Avondale. Hi, Laura. What are your thoughts?
Hi, I have a question about the food trucks that are being brought in for the Hemming Park events. And while the events themselves and the food trucks are great, my concern is that improving this traffic for the park itself may negatively impact the immediately surrounding businesses. And I'm wondering if any research has been done on this question, or if Friends of Hemming Park has sought feedback from the local restaurants about the impact, particularly on the Monday through Friday lunch businesses, on the small cafes that are immediately surrounding the park when we bring in four to six food trucks.
Thanks, Laura. Yeah,
that's a great question. And, you know, the response has been mixed, to be totally frank. You know, some vendors don't like that we have food trucks there. Some, such as Sweet Peas and Chamblin's, think it's wonderful. You know, when we have those events, there is a spillover effect. It creates more traffic and drives more business to these organizations. So.
And lots of tweets, Facebook comments coming in, and, oh, are the phones lighting up? Here are a couple of tweets. Lunch in the park is much nicer now than it was 2 years ago. Michelle Braun, CEO of our local United Way, tweets the show. It's so important to continue this great momentum. And on our First Coast Connect Facebook page, here are just a few of your comments. Hemming Park is Jacksonville's living room, and we need to take pride in our city. Here's another one from Katie. How would this be allocated differently than the $100,000 grant you recently received?
So this continues operations and management of the park. So this goes to everything from the ambassadors and security that we have to have, our social service worker, the programs and the marketing and the salaries for the staff. So it really just allocates the dollars to continue basic operations.
And let's go to Catherine in Jacksonville Beach as we discuss the fate of Friends of Hemming Park. Hi, Catherine. You're on the air.
Hi, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
I see that this is a pattern in Jacksonville, where we start amazingly great projects with the potential to revitalize the city, but then we like abandon them before they reach their full potential. And if we want to create change, we need to back it up with sustainable funding. Thanks.
Thanks, Catherine. Garrett is in Riverside. Go ahead, Garrett. What are your thoughts?
Yes, good morning. I would love to see Hemming Park turn into a some sort of food production system, like using a food forest systems, fruit trees, low maintenance perennials. This would, solve many of the issues that I've heard here, such as homelessness, kids getting involved, obesity. Producing healthy foods is always a good thing. We could employ the homelessness to install and maintain the area, use gardening techniques as education instruments to teach the children. And also all the production that would come from it could help the homeless down there to feed their stomachs as well. Using this holistic design, it utilizes all the problems and turns them into a solution. And plus, being known in America as having a downtown food forest would draw much attention to Jacksonville. Any thought on that?
Oh, thanks. Interesting.
Yeah, we have thought about that. It's come up quite a few times. You know, I'm a fan of permaculture. I understand a lot of the issues involved there. It hasn't been a huge priority for us, but we have looked into what it would take to create some container boxes for a garden. So we're looking into that.
Okay.
So that'll come later.
What would you define as your, beyond this immediate funding challenge, what is your biggest priority? How would you define that?
I think addressing the safety and security issues. So we have noticed the increase of women in the park. So it used to be about 1 in 10 people in the park were women, and now it's about 50-50. So women are typically an indicator of safety. When you start talking about placemaking and creating a public space, you want more women involved because that indicates that the place is a
and
safe place.
And placemaking is certainly a priority for cities all over America. Define that, could you, for our listeners?
Right. So placemaking is essentially making a destination that's worth visiting. And Project for Public Space has really defined this. And they were the leaders that helped create Bryant Park in New York. So they helped shepherd in the Southwest Airlines grant. We received $100,000 last year, which is going to the Black Sheep Project. And what that really states is that in a specific place, you have about 10 things to do within a walkable area. So if you take Hemming Park, that's everything from inside the park, the cafe, the kid zone, but it's also the neighbors that are in a walkable distance, Sweet Pete's, the main library, Mocha, you know, Chamberlain's bookstore. So we have that in downtown, so it's critical to keep that going and build that out more.
Let's take just a few more of your calls. Calls from neighborhoods all over town. Larry in Murray Hill. Hey, Larry. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for taking my call. Really quickly, just like a kudos to your guests for all of their intentions and what they're trying to do. I think Hemming Park is a beautiful place in downtown, and I think that, in addition to what a previous caller said, it does seem almost like a pattern, which the city has these wonderful ideas for restoration or renovation, and they may start them and then they fall short. My question, however, is it all in vain? The city, having developed the St. John's Town Center, is drawing all of the business and all of the pedestrian traffic and all of the nightlife and social business to that part of town. Are there enough resources, because this is a game about money now, are there enough resources in the city to support the development of both?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks, Larry.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think when we look at the data, though, that the trend is that more people are moving to urban centers, urban cores, millennials specifically. And then we have a lot of activity that is still, preparing to come downtown, the Chop House, Bold City Brewery, right?
Black Intuition Sheep is doing Aleworks,
Intuition Black Aleworks, Sheep. Right? Black yeah. Sheep. So they're seeing the investment is worthwhile. I think what we need is more residential, and of course, there's the Barnett Bank project and the Laura Street Trio, which I think have to come online. We are really counting on that for more of that density and foot traffic. And projects like that are a great example of why we need to keep investing in the city.
We have a call from downtown, Richard. Hi, Richard. Good morning.
Hey. Good morning. As a downtown merchant of 45 years downtown, I want to just throw my lot in and I hate to be negative, but you can have all the projects you want, but until you address the problem of the alcoholics, schizophrenics, people who really are not homeless because they don't have a home, it's because that's where they want to be. And as long as that group of people are downtown, you are wasting your time. And if anybody has any doubts about what I say, I implore them to go downtown and just walk all around the park and see if it's somewhere you'd like to spend some time.
Okay.
That's all I got to say.
What's your business, Richard? Oh, he hung up. Well, okay. There you have a downtown business owner giving his thoughts. As he's been downtown for decades. What about his concerns?
So I think every downtown faces a similar issue. You know, you look at Los Angeles, which has tons of great public space, but they also have tent forests on the street. You know, there's tons of homeless people. And so I don't think any downtown is going to 100% get rid of the homeless per se, but we need to have a concerted effort from all the stakeholders to figure out how to address those concerns collectively. And I think that is having more people, more social service workers specifically looking for the people in need and find the services that they need to have.
And here's one more piece of feedback on Twitter from Bold City Pops. Hemming Park open means revenue for small business owners like us. We are thankful for the opportunity to serve downtown from the urban core. So with all of this said, tell us about tonight.
So tonight at 5 o'clock is the city council meeting. We are going to find out more about what's going to be presented today. At 11:30, there's a notice meeting between Councilwoman Boyer and Councilman Gulliford to discuss what bill's going to be proposed. But at 5 o'clock, if you can come and show your support, maybe say a few words for Hemming Park, and I expect to go through a little presentation about our impact and value, and expect to have the funding passed tonight.
Well, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Melissa.
Vince Cavan heads up Friends of Hemming Park. We'll continue to follow that story here on the show and on 89.9 all through the day. Meanwhile, much more still ahead. Later, don't miss the live in-studio performance, a preview of this weekend's Florida Folk Festival. And up next, marking Stroke Awareness Month. Back in a moment.
WJZT and Baptist Health are pleased to announce that Amy Robach, news anchor of ABC's Good Morning America, will be this year's afternoon keynote speaker at Girls Day Out, September 17, 2016, Hyatt Regency Riverfront Hotel. Amy is also a breast cancer awareness advocate and author of My Breast Cancer Journey, From Fighter to Thriver. For more information or for tickets, log on to wjct.org/girlsdayout.
I'm Rick Mullaney, Director of the Public Policy Institute at Jacksonville University. Join me for WJCT's quarterly program, Policy Matters. On each installment, we look at how public policy affects our lives. Join the conversation as we speak with Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry and Greg Anderson, President of the Jacksonville City Council. That's on the next Policy Matters, Thursday morning at 9 on 89.9 WJCT.
I've got nothing. I'm a 52-year-old man, and I've got nothing. No wife, no kids. I have my second chance. I had it.
On the new season of the TV series Marin, Mark Maron's character has become addicted to Oxy, squandered his success, and entered rehab. On the next Fresh Air, Maron talks about addiction and his 16 years of sobriety. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
One doesn't like to think about it this way, but with refugee resettlement comes big bureaucracy.
PA is principal applicant, WI is wife, 2MI is two minors, and then survivor means survivor of torture.
I'm Kai Rizdal. They are people, yes, stuck inside a very big government machine. That is next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, stroke is the number one cause of disability and the fifth leading cause of death in the U.S. And your independence following a stroke depends on many critical factors like getting immediate medical attention, where you're treated, and how you're treated. It could mean the difference between a full recovery or a permanent disability. May is National Stroke Awareness Month. Joining us now are attorneys Matt Soule and Fadi Shakur, M.D., from the Terrell Hogan Law Firm, both national leaders representing stroke victims nationwide. Gentlemen, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
So this is a relatively new field of litigation, correct? Why is that?
Well, there have been a lot of improvements in stroke care over the last 10 years. And there's with those improvements, there's been a real emphasis on standardizing stroke care. So when somebody has a stroke now, it's pretty easy to tell whether they have received appropriate care. But I think probably the biggest reason is because with those improvements in stroke care, more people are surviving stroke than they would before. So before they'd have a stroke and they'd die from it. Now they're living, surviving their stroke, but they're doing so with significant disabilities. And so when somebody has a stroke, they return to their family. They're followed by just massive medical bills. Typically, the principal breadwinner is no longer able to return to work. They either had the stroke themselves or they're having to care for the person that had stroke. They're wiped out financially. They're not able to provide the care. And usually that's 24-hour, 7-day-a-week care. They get devastated. And they have no option. Many times, if someone was at fault, if someone was responsible for the outcome, they usually don't have any options but to try to find some way to hold the person responsible for the outcome accountable for those damages. They really have no other choice.
What are the most common errors, then, that could be avoided when it comes to treatment of stroke?
There are multiple errors that could be avoided when it comes to stroke. What's really frustrating is the scenario where the emergency department personnel fail to activate a hospital stroke protocol. A stroke protocol is a plan that each and every stroke center has to deal with patients exhibiting signs and symptoms of stroke. So we've seen it too many times that the ER doctor or other personnel recognize the stroke symptoms but fail to activate that protocol. We've also seen an instance or two where the ER physician or personnel activate the stroke protocol, but they fail to carry through with all the steps that comes with that protocol, which leads and causes a significant delay. And we know time is brain, and because of that delay, the person is left with severe disabilities.
And there are two types of stroke facilities. A patient can be taken to a primary stroke center versus a comprehensive stroke center?
Yes, there are two kinds, a primary and comprehensive stroke centers. The primary stroke centers are limited with the options they have in treating stroke. Comprehensive stroke centers have more advanced options such as endovascular intervention where a neuroradiologist, for instance, can go into the blood vessel and actually in the brain and actually physically retrieve that clot and restore blood flow, whereas primary stroke centers are usually limited to what we call drip and ship. Basically, they infuse the patient with the medication, the clot buster medication, then ship them to the comprehensive stroke center.
So if a family member is felled by stroke, what steps should their loved ones take to make sure that they have the best possible outcome?
I think it's important to have a plan right now in advance. You don't want to, you know, time is brain. Probably talked about that. Everybody knows that when it comes to stroke. But it's important to have that plan in advance. You don't want to be thinking, where do I need to be taken when I'm having a stroke?
Most people would just call 911 and leave it up to the EMTs, right?
Well, that's if they're having a specific stroke. Okay, they're having a stroke, but sometimes they have a TIA. And this is not uncommon, a transient ischemic attack. And what they'll do is instead of following up and calling 911 and going to the emergency department of a stroke center, sometimes they'll go to a walk-in care clinic or make a doctor's appointment.
Right.
That's too late. The time is brain isn't just for treating the stroke, it's for identifying what conditions are responsible for causing those symptoms and treating those before the person has a massive stroke. That's very, very common.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be number one. You'd also want to have a list of medications, but figure out where you want to go. Not all stroke centers are the same. There's a comprehensive stroke center, the primary stroke care center, the comprehensive ones, if that's closest to you, that's where you should be taken.
Anything else people should know?
Many times, and we've seen it happen a lot, that the emergency doctors or personnel fail to recognize the stroke symptoms and attribute that to either being under the influence of alcohol or drugs, because the symptoms, classic symptoms, have slurred speech, numbness, sometimes it's dizziness. And we've seen it where a patient was told that he had too much alcohol and was sent home, and the next day he was paralyzed. We've seen one instance where a patient's loved one was told, "Don't worry, your mother is just under the influence of drugs. Let her sleep it off." And then the patient's daughter came and saw her drowning in her own urine, and only to discover she had a stroke.
Wow. Well, it is National Stroke Awareness Month. Important information for families to know. They are attorneys Matt Soule and Fadi Shakur from the Terrell Hogan Law Firm, both leaders in stroke litigation. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
Much more still to come. Keep listening for a live in-studio performance from the Florida Folk Festival. And up next, fostering radical collaboration at your office. We'll tell you how.
Superstorm Sandy devastated the East Coast in 2012, but it wasn't a disaster for everybody. For some, Sandy was big money.
I saw blanket denials across the board.
Insurance companies made millions, but homeowners suffered.
We're average middle-class people, and we're in ruins here.
NPR and Frontline investigate the business of disaster later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Spend some time in the Square, an online venue for local artists. WJCT invites you to vote for your favorite submission. Vote now through the end of the month. To learn more about the Square and to place your vote, visit wjct.org/thesquare.
In 1971, Robert Rosenthal was working an entry-level job for the New York Times when an editor called with the story of a lifetime.
He says, "I want you to come to room 1111 at the Hilton Hotel tomorrow, and don't tell anyone where you're going, and bring enough clothes for at least a month."
And down the rabbit hole we go.
I slept in a room with two huge filing cabinets. I slept with the Pentagon Papers.
On the next episode of Reveal.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, it's a workshop happening in Jacksonville this week, and it's designed to build collaboration within your organization. If you're interested in building trust and transforming adversarial relationships at your workplace into fruitful partnerships, well, then you need to learn about radical collaboration. Ron Luett and Jim Tam, co-authors of Radical Collaboration, are here along with consultant Celeste Blackman to tell us more about this concept. Good morning to you all.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, let's begin, Ron, with you. What is radical collaboration?
Well, it's a mindset and intention and a set of tools to try to build a relationship based on trust and focus more on the first on the quality of the relationship before getting a one-off deal. So its aim is to create as much as possible mutual gain and long-term trust between the parties.
So, Jim, you're transforming what many view as a zero-sum game into a win-win for all parties. Is that right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Why is that, Celeste, why, and Jim, why is that so much easier said than done in most workplaces?
Well, most people are very protective, of their own interest, and they're not thinking about the interest of the other parties. So if we can get people to see that there are opportunities to work together and improve the solutions for everybody, it expands the pie.
Celeste, how do you do this? This workshop is coming up Wednesday through Friday at the new Unity Plaza. And let me just read some of the goals. Get out of a survival mindset and into a high-performance mindset. Reduce defensive behaviors. Transform adversarial relationships into partnerships and high-trust collaborative environments. I don't think there's a friend or a colleague I have that wouldn't want that for their own organization. Those are issues I think that go through almost all organizations in one way or another.
Yeah, I would even say that go through all families and all relationships, all interactions that people have, because most of us haven't had very much support, very much training, very much development in these areas. And so what we seek to do is really offer some tools, some methodologies, and some practices to help people gain the attitude, the mindset, and the skills to be more effective in their collaborative relationships.
Now, one of them you call a green zone culture. Ron, what's that? What's a green zone culture?
Well, it is one of the three choices we teach is that people walk in with a particular mindset and story they have in their mind about other people. And so we ask people to get a sense of whether they're in the red zone, which is primarily aggressive.
Yeah.
And the stance is, I better protect myself. This is going to be a battle. And so every man for himself. And most of that we learn early. We don't even know that's our attitude. That's the sort of default position. A variation of that, in the sense that it's still in the red zone, but we call it much more pink and it's much more common, is this is uncomfortable. I don't want to deal with this. I want to avoid anything uncomfortable. So I'll just keep my mouth shut or avoid or sabotage you. Or
at the very least, I won't help you. I'll just sit silently.
I'll sit still.
Yeah, I'll sit still.
You know? And you can see it's connected to the lower brainstem. If we get scared, the first thing we do is freeze. So a lot of people at work just freeze. They don't.
And it's unfortunate, but I've seen it really everywhere I've ever worked. It's hard to change that dynamic. Can you share with us some of the tools that you use to try to break down that dynamic and build a better one?
Yeah, in our experience, a lot of people are in the red zone or in the pink zone because they don't have the skills, the tools to be any other way. They think that's the most effective way they can be. So we found that if we can get people to become more aware of what their mindset is and then give them some basic skills, negotiating skills, attitudinal issues that they can be more aware of, listening skills, this is not really super complex stuff, but it does make a huge difference in an organization if people become a little more skillful.
Can you share with us how it's worked in organizations you've consulted with? What have been some of the before and afters you've seen?
I can give you some of that, yeah. We started this as a pilot project out in California where we're working with collective bargaining disputes. And so we had a lot of funding from the Hewlett Foundation in the state of California. And over a 3.5-year period, we reduced the amount of measurable conflict in almost 100 different organizations by 70%. These are things like unfair labor practice charges, requests for mediators, requests for fact finders. It saved the state of California a huge amount of money, enough so that the state legislature created a nonprofit foundation to keep it available in the public sector.
Wow. So organizations need to realize they'll have happier employees, it sounds like, but it improves the bottom line as well.
And that's really primarily what we're trying to let organizations know, that it's not just that it makes for a nicer working environment, a healthier working environment, better decisions are made, but the bottom line is impacted dramatically and effectively when people work better together. And we find that you can't collaborate or you can't compete externally if you can't first collaborate internally.
Do you when you work with an organization, do you reach out to the leadership first and you got to get them to buy in and then they bring along the whole staff? Or how do you bring in the entire organization and transmit this through what can often be a really big bureaucratic apparatus, I would think?
I think if you're trying to change the whole culture of an organization, at some point in time you need to get the leadership on board. But oftentimes we don't have the luxury of starting at the top and working down. So we go to, you know, who's ready? Who wants to make that difference? Who realizes that they need to be more effective at collaboration? We start there and then it spreads throughout the organization.
Interesting. So with all of that said, this is coming up beginning tomorrow at Unity Plaza. How can people be part of this?
They can contact us through the website at greenzoneculturegroup.com, and the workshop starts tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.
All right. Very interesting stuff. Thanks so much for joining us, Ron Lewitt, Jim Tam, co-authors of Radical Collaboration, consultant Celeste Blackman, all with us this morning. Again, that's Wednesday through Friday at the downtown, or actually the Brooklyn area, Unity Plaza. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And in a moment, a special treat, a live in-studio performance as we look ahead to this weekend's Florida Folk Festival. Keep listening.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning, live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross.
Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, President Obama lifts the embargo against U.S. arms sales to Vietnam. What closer ties between the U.S. and Vietnam mean for trade, leverage on human rights, and growing concerns over China's military expansion? At 10 o'clock on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
On the next Jazz Night in America, New Orleans' best-kept secret, trumpeter Leroy Jones.
I'm not trying to play Dixieland. I don't know what Dixieland is. I do, but I don't. I'm just trying to play some jazz.
We're on location in Louisiana at the Dewdrop Jazz and Social Hall. That's on the next Jazz Night in America. I'm Christian McBride.
Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Thursdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Big day at the job. Make it break time. They're all waiting for you right now in the conference room. Well, they're going to have to wait because you're not leaving the radio until you hear the end of that story. Snap judgment from NPR. Storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
Sundays at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, it's a three-day celebration of the music, dance, stories, crafts, and food that make Florida unique. Throughout the Memorial Day weekend, you need to come out for hundreds of performances giving voice and meaning to the state's heritage at the Florida Folk Festival. It'll be along the banks of the Suwannee River at Stephen Foster Folk Culture Center State Park, home of the festival for some 64 years. Here with more, we welcome Richard Borders and performer Madison Carr. She's a 15-year-old singer from Jacksonville's Douglas Anderson School of the Arts. Good morning to you both.
Good morning. Good morning.
All right, Madison, you're performing Friday and Saturday at the festival, is that right?
Yes, ma'am, and Sunday.
And Sunday.
Yes, ma'am.
You're 15, you're a music student at DA. How exciting is this to be part of this storied event?
Yeah, it's really amazing. I've always dreamed of playing in festivals. I've been a performer my whole life, and I've been in festivals, but this is a big one, so I'm really happy about it.
Wow. Yes, ma'am. Richard Borders, you shoot video segments right here in studio every day for the show for our partner TVJax.com, which we love having you. What many may not know is that you also have had a long career in music and video production. You are on a first-name basis with so many music legends, I can't even begin to give all of the names. But one of them is Arlo Guthrie, is that right?
Exactly. I wound up meeting him, quite a show with him, but we were together at the March on Washington with Pete Seeger and happened to meet Coretta King there, too. So it was an exciting experience that particular time, but I'll be looking forward to seeing him Saturday, but looking more forward to seeing Madison play again. I've been so excited to work with her.
You'll be videotaping her performance.
I'll be videotaping three days of her and Complicated Animals, my friends Monica and Chad, too, and a lot of musicians from Jacksonville are there, Larry Magnum.
That's right, and but it has literally, I couldn't believe this, more than 300 performances.
It's extraordinary. It's amazing. You know, there's so much music in Florida. I've really been excited to work in so many different festivals here and stuff.
Right. A rich musical history in Madison. What is it about this type of music that you enjoy, folk music?
Well, folk music really takes me back to my childhood. I grew up listening to a lot of Johnny Cash and Bob Dylan and John Lennon. And folk music, especially in Florida, it just takes me to a really happy place. And I think folk music has definitely lost popularity amongst my age group. So if we can bring that back, you know, that's what I'm trying to do.
Excellent. So what are you going to be performing for us?
Well, I'm going to be performing an original that I wrote, and it's called Better Place. And I have a lot of humanitarian activist beliefs, but I really think it just boils down to trying to make the world a better place. And I think music has a lot of power to do that. So that's what this song is about.
Excellent. Well, we're pleased to hear this now live in studio. She's 15-year-old DA student Madison Carr.
Thank you. Do you ever wonder why is the sky blue? It makes us so untrue. And technology, it's creeping in. Wouldn't your God think it a sin? Well, we all want the world to be a better place. You find it in your forms the name of amazing grace. And I just wonder what made it this way. And happiness, it's a state of mind. You say the more you seek it, the more you can find. But lately, it's been hard to find the source. Feelings are like dominoes. One starts falling, the next thing you know, we all are, for better or for worse. Oh, and they come home with streaming tears. They have their dreams, but they have their fears. And I know it's hard to pick the right road. And we all want a better place. But you're fighting in uniforms in the name of amazing grace. And I just wonder what made it this way. And happiness, it's a state of mind. You say the more you seek it, the more you can find. But lately, it's been hard to find the source. Our feelings are like dominoes. One starts falling, the next thing you know, we all are, for better or for worse. And we all want a better place. But you're fighting in uniforms in the name of amazing grace. And I just wonder what made it this way. And and happiness. It's a state of mind. You say the more you seek it, the more you can find. But lately, it's been hard to find the source. La 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 la, la da da da, la 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 la.
Madison Carr.
Thank you.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And you can catch Madison Carr every day this weekend at the 64th Annual Florida Folk Festival along the banks of the Suwannee River at Stephen Foster Folk Culture Center State Park. Madison, our own Richard Borders, thanks so much for being here.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.
And that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Shevchik. Never miss a show. Make sure to subscribe to the Daily Podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and watch the show with our partners' video on demand segments at tvjax.com. Next on Diane Rehm, President Obama lifts the embargo against U.S. arms sales to Vietnam. A look at what closer ties between the U.S. and Vietnam mean for trade, leverage on human rights, and concerns over China's military expansion. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.